crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. Thank you very much for listening in today. Well, we're partway through Hanukkah, which is this celebration that's over 2,000 years old to celebrate the dedication or the rededication of the temple after it was desecrated by the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes. And we're going to talk about this man Antiochus today and what he did to the ancient Jewish kingdom. But before I do that, I want to go back to a 2015 discovery which took place right here in Jerusalem outside the Ottoman city walls between the City of David and the Dung Gate, if you're familiar with Jerusalem's terrain. We're going to listen to archaeologist Doron Ben-Ami, who excavated there at Givati, or this parking lot as it's called, right by the southern entrance into the old city of Jerusalem. Again, this was back in 2015, and he's announcing a special discovery.
One of the greatest discoveries uncovered here in the Chenyon Givati is a complicated fortification system that was discovered here in the recent month. It includes a wide city wall, a large monumental tower, and a glacis. Together with so many coins, all are dated to the Seleucid presence here in Jerusalem, we can actually view again the the real history of Jerusalem here in front of our eyes, that includes the tower recently discovered, part of the city wall, okay, a large glacis going all the way sloping down to the Tropeon Valley, and this mirrors in the other side with other remains that were uncovered years ago in Area G, in the other side of the hill, and all together help us reconstruct again this fortress, stronghold, that used to house the upper part of the city of David here. This is part of the Hellenistic aqua, so well documented in different historical sources. Among the relevant ones are Josephus and Maccabean Book 1. And they all tell us about the history here in this city, but so far archaeologists failed to uncover remains that could be securely dated and related to this fortress.
Again, that was archaeologist Doron Ben-Ami talking about the discovery as he sees it of the Acra, this fortress that was made around the early part of the 2nd century BCE. And what he failed to mention in that clip, though, was the person that constructed that fortress. And for that, we need to go to the historical book of 1 Maccabees. This is a historical book written by an eyewitness from the time. You might have heard of this book, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees as well. Those books are less reliable historically just because they're written after the events they purport to describe. But this book is an accurate historical account. And this is what it says there in the first book. Quote, "He plundered the city of Jerusalem and set fire to it, demolished its houses and its surrounding walls, took captive the women and children, and seized the cattle. Then they built up the city of David with its high, massive wall and strong towers, and it became their citadel, their Acra." And so this is talking about the work of Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV, and how after he had ransacked Jerusalem, desecrated the temple, how he built up a fortress in Jerusalem, in the northern part of the city of David. That's what it says in Maccabees, and that's what it says in Josephus also. And that's where they have found this structure from that period. Now, I will mention, having visited that site in the last few months, Doron Ben-Ami is gone now as far as the archaeologists there. Now there's two archaeologists that are leading that, and we were toured, Christopher Eames, myself, and myself, by Yiftach Shalev. He is the co-director now, and he believes that it might not be the Acra. He has a different theory about it. But as I looked at it and looking at the discussion, both the historical sources and what they've found, I still think it is the Acra. I still think that the dating does check out, considering that the Acra was built towards the end of Antiochus Epiphanes' reign. Nevertheless, whether this is or it isn't, the historical accounts of the Acra being built fits right into this time period of Antiochus Epiphanes' life, just after he came back on a rampage from Egypt into the Holy Land as he was retreating back into Seleucid territory. And so this construction of this fortress was largely to keep the Jews at bay, to keep them down, to guide what happens on the temple, to ensure there isn't a rebellion from the massive process of Hellenizing the Jews, forced conversion against the laws of their fathers. Now, I'll leave a link to an article that describes more about this Acra. But today I want to talk about who was this man, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, importantly, the Bible prophesies that there are going to be end time types of Antiochus Epiphanes on the scene that in many ways mimic and imitate the destructive work of this earlier Antiochus Epiphanes. And so today, on today's program, we're going to look back at the original Antiochus from 2,000 years ago. We're going to look at some historical sources that really capture the personality, the character, and the political objectives of the original Antiochus. And as we do that, we can more readily understand and recognize the latter-day types that are on the scene today. Now, before you do away with this program, because I'm talking about a latter-day type of Antiochus Epiphanes, understand that the presence of Antiochus Epiphanes anciently was actually the fulfillment of a prophecy as well. The book of Daniel was written before Antiochus came on the scene, and you'll see as we go through part of this today, it did accurately forecast the first Antiochus Epiphanes, and it surely then will accurately forecast the latter day type as well. Now, this is a very detailed fulfillment. It's one of the prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong uses in his book Proof of the Bible to show God's power to bring events to pass that are prophesied in the book, in the Bible. So to set this up, we need to put our historical helmets on and go digging just to see the context of when Antiochus Epiphanes existed. And we should start by talking about Alexander the Great briefly. He conquered the known world in the late 4th century, converting a lot of the peoples over to a Hellenistic culture, a Greek-dominated culture, over all the way over to, I guess it was about to Pakistan, something like that, across the known world. Well, he died quite young, and the kingdom that he that came from him was largely fragmented because of all the different peoples that he quickly overcame. And so after about 20 years of kind of infighting among the contenders for power after Alexander the Great, you had four kingdoms. And two of those kingdoms would really directly concern the land of Judea. The land of Judea was governed at first by the Ptolemaic kingdom, and this was known in the Bible as the King of the South. This was based in Egypt. Initially, the King of the South, this Ptolemaic kingdom, was stronger than the rival Seleucid kingdom, or the King of the North, as Daniel's prophecy brings out, just because it already had an effective government in place that the ruler Ptolemy inherited. He was over a period, people that kind of had one mind, one religion, and they treated him as the new pharaoh or the new king. Now, the Seleucid kingdom, this territory was massive, huge, and it had a hodgepodge of peoples that covered this large area from Syria to India. And so this Seleucid kingdom was much harder to unify, which was why it took quite a number of years before it became strong. So at first, we had Judea being ruled over from about 300 to 200 BCE, ruled over by the Ptolemaic kingdom. And of course, through this period, you had Jews living here. The remnant that returned under Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, they stayed there. They lived there. They lived underneath and by the graces of the Persian Empire as a small province of the Persian Empire until this time. And when Alexander the Great came down, the Jews basically saluted him, and Alexander the Great let them live. And so they continued to function as a society that was underneath the empire of the day, yet they did have quite a lot of autonomy to go about their religion as they saw fit. Alexander the Great and the Ptolemaic Empire, they did not seek to forcefully convert the Jews at all, but rather let them worship in the way that they wanted. They let them go, and that is the way that it continued even into Seleucid rule. There was a critical war, I think it was in about 198 BCE, between the southern kingdom of Ptolemy and the northern kingdom of Seleucus. And that's when the Seleucid Empire eventually came to control Judea. Now, under one of these kings of the Seleucid Empire, the Jews faced the most dire threat upon the religion, the Bible, that they had ever seen. If you go back to even when they went into captivity, Babylonian captivity, Jeremiah prophesied to them that they, after a time, would be able to return. And Isaiah said that was going to be under a Persian king, Cyrus. They would be able to return and continue worshiping God and continue having the Bible as their holy text. And that would continue that freedom, as I said. But under the rule of the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes, that would be put to an end, or almost to an end. The truth of God, the Bible, almost got snuffed out. Now, that's not the way things started. Antiochus Epiphanes, at the beginning of his reign, he started ruling in 175 BCE, and he continued kind of the policy of his father, of his brother, and then his father before him, at allowing the Jews to worship in the way that they deemed fit. But Hellenism had already been taking control of the Jewish intellectual circles, of the leadership of the Jews. You already had infighting amongst the high priest Onias and Jason, both of them committed to a certain level of Hellenization of Jerusalem. There was a gymnasium set up. Some of the Jews are actually, as they studied in this Greek school, were actually trying to hide the fact that they were Jews. They were going to certain lengths to even cover up their circumcision, if you can imagine that. And so there was already this push towards a Hellenistic way of life in Jerusalem at the beginning of Antiochus Epiphanes' reign, and even before that. Now, it wouldn't come till closer to the end of Antiochus Epiphanes' reign that he would not just try and destroy the religion of the Jews, not just try and make sure it was watered down, because it was already watered down. The truth was already watered down, as 1 Maccabees brings out. He was trying to get rid of the text. He was trying to get rid of the Bible. The Bible, whether you're a Christian, Jewish, whatever, that you read, it almost didn't last Antiochus Epiphanes' reign. It was almost snuffed out, destroyed, totally wiped out. That was his policy, that he was going to destroy every last vestige of the truth. Every scrap, every document was to be gone, torched. And if you were found with one of those copies, you'd be burned as well. You would be killed as well. Now, what possessed a man to go after the religion in this way, go after the Bible in this way? Again, it wasn't this a type of just killing the Jews for the Jews' sake, or that type of anti-Semitism that we see so rife today, though this was anti-Semitic, I'm not going to say that, but it was against the truth. This was a war that he waged against the biblical source. And he tried, and he did try his best to get rid of it, and he got close. Now, what possessed a man to go ahead and do this? Now, it's interesting, looking at all the historical accounts about Antiochus Epiphanes' life, is no one can really nail down the reason of his animosity against the Jews or the Jewish religion. Why did he care so much? It wasn't a threat at the time to his kingdom, the way that they were living, or the law that they kept, the law that they held in the Torah. It wasn't a danger to him at all. They were good tax-paying people, it seemed. What possessed him to try and destroy the truth? Now, it was on one of his return journeys from Egypt. A very unsuccessful foreign policy decision of his was to try and take over the Ptolemaic kingdom. And he did get close. He got close to doing that, the Ptolemies again, in Egypt. But the Ptolemaic kingdom at that moment had an ally, and that ally was the Roman Republic. This is what it says in Daniel 11, verse 30. And now just remember, again, the book of Daniel is dual. It's prophecy for our day. It's also prophecy for this time, during Antiochus's time as well. And this is what Daniel 11, verse 30 says. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, that is Antiochus Epiphanes, and he shall be cowed, and shall he shall return. And so this is talking about a specific act that's historical, that we know as history now, where Antiochus Epiphanes was going down into Egypt, and just as he was getting into Egyptian territory, you had the Roman fleet that came from Kittim at the time was Cyprus, and basically drew a line in the sand, which was around Antiochus Epiphanes, and this was the Roman messenger that did this, that who actually Antiochus Epiphanes was familiar with from his early education in Rome. But he drew took out his sword or a stick, we're not sure what he did, but he drew a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes, and he said, yes or no, before you can come out of this circle, I want you to answer yes or no. Yes, you're going to retreat back to Seleucia or Antioch where you came from, or no, you're going to fight the Ptolemies, and with them you're going to bring the might of the Roman Republic against you. And Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't a dummy, though he was a madman, though he thought himself as God manifest, which is what Epiphanes means. He decided to retreat. He wouldn't take on the Roman Republic. And it was when he retreated that he did this. This is the rest of Daniel 11, verse 30, and this is from the Jewish Publication Society. It says this, I'll read it from the very beginning. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, Antiochus Epiphanes, and he shall be cowed, and he shall return back to where he came from, so back towards the north through Judea. And as he does that, continuing the quote, and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. That's what he took his wrath out against, the Holy Covenant. And shall do his pleasure, and he shall return and have regard unto them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And so he came back up through Judea, and he took his wrath out completely upon the Jews. And he even got some help from some of the more extreme Jewish rulers that had swallowed Hellenism completely and were fine at that point getting rid of the law. There were some, not everyone, not even the majority, were fine with it. But nevertheless, Antiochus Epiphanes did take out his wrath on the Jews for whatever reason. Now, some say it was maybe because there was this infighting amongst the high priestly line. And one of the high priests, that Menelaus was his name, that Antiochus Epiphanes set up as high priest, he was removed from power because the other camp thought that Antiochus Epiphanes was dead, and then he wasn't dead, and so he was coming back and taking his wrath out on one of the camps. But really, historians don't know why Antiochus did this. This is how Christopher Wordsworth in the early 19th century talks about Antiochus's wrath on the Jews. He says this, quote, "The secret springs of this impious purpose is not easy to discover. We can readily comprehend why an ambitious monarch should invade a neighboring province, and why a covetous prince should pillage an opulent temple in an ancient city, in order to aggrandize and enrich himself. But why, after he had done all this, he should proceed to compel the inhabitants of that city and worshippers in that temple, as Antiochus and Epiphanes endeavored to force the Jews, to eat certain meats prohibited as unclean by their laws, and to give up the copies of their sacred books to be burned, and to partake in idolatrous sacrifices, and to join idolatrous processions, and why he should forbid them to circumcise their children, to observe their Sabbaths and holy days, and to offer the daily sacrifice, and why he should proceed to torture and destroy thousands of them, his own subjects, if they refused to obey his commands and abandon their religion and adopt heathenism for which he cared but little. It's not so easy to explain," Wordsworth writes, "why he did all this. And then he says this: for my own part, I frankly confess that I recognize here the working of the evil one. And indeed, it's baffling to see why does he go through this much, these lengths? Why does he go through these lengths to not just pillage and take the money, but destroy these texts? These texts, the Bible, as it was recorded at that time. Why was he going after it? Now, it was probably around this time that Antiochus, as he was retreating, going back through Judea, announcing this policy, ransacking the temple, setting up the abomination of desolation inside the temple, making it impure, stopping the daily sacrifice, evening and morning sacrifice that was done on the altar outside the temple. That was stopped. This is probably about the same time where he wrote a formal decree to his realm to try and stamp out this religion completely and to stamp out and get rid of the copies of the law. Yes, Antiochus had destroyed many Jews, but he wasn't satisfied. He wasn't satisfied. He wanted the complete destruction of the word of God. This is what 1 Maccabees says in 1 Maccabees 1, verse 41 to 50, says this: "Then the king," which is Antiochus Epiphanes, "wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that each should give up his customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many even from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by every unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change the ordinances. And then it said, whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die." So this was an edict, a political edict from the king of this territory to stamp out all of the religion completely and observance of it, and even the books of the law themselves. People do focus on the fact that he was wiping out many of the Jews, and that's indeed true, and I don't want to belittle that at all. But the real target of this, the real target was the truth of God, the Word, the Torah, the books of the Bible. That's what he was going after entirely. Yes, you could wipe out a people, but that wasn't enough for Antiochus. He was going after the books. He was going after the truth. He was going after that constitution of the Jews. He wanted to wipe it out. And I don't think we realize how close he got to doing exactly that. Now, thankfully, there were a few that were willing to stand up to this king Antiochus Epiphanes. And without them, I mean, it looks like the book of the law, the Bible as we know it, it wouldn't have gone through this period. But there was somebody that was willing to stand up. Now, it was about this time that the Seleucid Empire were trying to enforce this apostasy, as it's called in Maccabees, throughout the land of Judea, not just in Jerusalem. This was meant to be everywhere. Send out search parties, make sure everybody converts, make sure everybody sacrifices swine on these pagan altars that they just built up in all the little towns, make sure nobody's circumcising their kids, make sure if you find any book copies of the law, they're burnt, and if anybody's reading it, they get killed. There were different parties of Seleucid soldiers that were sent out to enforce this. And they had great success. The broad majority, while a lot of them wouldn't have been definitely not happy by this, I'm not saying they wanted it or encouraged it, they went along with it. People were going along with the changes. Now, I'm not saying it would be easy to stand up at all. I mean, Antiochus was presenting two options, death or obedience. You listen to what I do, listen to what I say, fulfill my commands, or death. Those were the choices. And there were some that did choose death. And some were like, well, if we can't obey this law, then then we might as well just die. There's no point living. Well, thankfully, that wasn't the choice of everybody. And this is where we get introduced to the heroes of the Hanukkah story, or history, I should say. And there was a town in the northern area of Judea, far from Jerusalem, far from the really important people, the really important religious figures of the day, far from the high priests, far from the Sanhedrin of the day also. You had a Levitical priest in this town of Modin, whose name was Mattathias, and he came from the family of the Hasmoneans, or those that came from him would be known as the Hasmoneans. They would also be known as the Maccabees, named after Judah, one of the sons of Mattathias. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes sent out these representatives to try and forcefully shut down any type of worship or destroy every copy of the law that they found. And this is what happens when this entourage gets to this city of Modin. This is 1 Maccabees 2, verse 18 to 28. It says, then the king's officers who were enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modin to make them offer sacrifice. Many from Israel came to them, and Mattathias and his sons were assembled. Then the king's officers spoke to Mattathias as follows, quote, you are a leader, honored and great in this city, and supported by sons and brothers. Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king, and you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. So notice this, that all in Jerusalem, the other men of Judah, they'd already done this. Now many would have us believe that Modin, because it was in the north of Judea, that this was the first stop en route to religiously cleanse Judea. But that's not what this Maccabees says. Maccabees says that this verse shows that the majority had already caved in, accepting the dictates of Antiochus. There were others that died, I said, rather than being Hellenized. But there was no one that was willing to fight for the truth. Not someone in Jerusalem, not someone around the temple. It was only this man and his family on the very outskirts of the Judean province that was willing to hold fast to the truth. This is what 1 Maccabees says. Now it continues in verse 19, I believe it is. It says this, but Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, quote, so this is the Hasmonean leader now, the father of Judas Maccabee, who would eventually come 3 years after this point, or just under 3 years after this point, take back the temple. This is what he said, Mattathias, quote, even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each one from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. And so defiantly, here as all the townspeople are assembled with these Seleucid soldiers, with this altar that's there, with swine ready to be offered, Mattathias says, no, we're not going to do it. And just imagine this moment of just extremely tense. Somebody here finally has said, no, I'm not going to do what you say. Neither are my sons. We're not going to change. We're going to hold on to this. We're going to fight for it if we have to. Now, not everybody there wanted to go along with Mattathias. They saw this as sure death to go along with Mattathias. And so it says in verse 23 here, when he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer the sacrifice upon the altar in Modin according to the king's commands. And when Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal, and his heart was stirred, and he gave vent to righteous anger, and he ran and killed that man upon the altar. And at the same time, he killed the king's officers. The king's officers are Antiochus Epiphanes' officers, who was forcing them to sacrifice. He tore down the altar, and thus he burned with zeal for the law, as Phinehas did against Zimri, the son of Salu, Then Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, quote, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me." And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all they had in the city. This is remarkable when you think about it, just because there was so much stacked against Mattathias. And yet he understood the importance of the truth. He understood the importance of the law. And while others would have did lay down their lives and say, "We're not going to do it, you can kill me," Mattathias probably had a little bit more vision than that. He understood what was on the line. As he says there, it says, "Everyone who's zealous for the law and supports the covenant, come out with me." He was zealous for the law. He was zealous for perpetuating the law. He was going to make sure the truth, the law, wasn't stamped out completely. What good does dying do at this point if everything, all the copies of the law are going to be torched? Then the nobody will be able to continue. Our posterity will not be able to continue. That's what was on the line here, and Mattathias recognized it. It wasn't that the survival of the Jewish people was on the line as far as a race. It was that the survival of the law itself was on the line. And those that were zealous for the law, they did come and join Mattathias. They joined him. After he soon thereafter died, but then Judas ruled after him. And Judas, in a couple of years' time, would take back the temple from Antiochus's men. They would, for the next 20 or so years, still have the Acra to contend with because it was just so hard to destroy. Yet Judas was able to purify the temple, and they were able to restore the daily sacrifice. This is what Daniel chapter 11 and verse 32 says. It says, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant, shall he, Antiochus Epiphanes, corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." There's going to be a few people, and anciently this was typed by this Maccabean family, the family of the Hasmoneans, that were willing to stand up and fight for the truth, fight to preserve what was revealed to them. And because of them, it was a few years after they gained more and more power, and they stood up to the kingdom. You've got to think about Mattathias here. I mean, I'm just blown away by his level of faith, to the point that it was him and his family against Antiochus Epiphanes and the entire Seleucid kingdom that dominated the territory from Egypt all the way across through to India. That's who this family was going up against. And he said, "I don't care who I'm going up against. I've got faith that God is going to deliver me." And indeed, he did. And we all, to this day, if you read the law, the books of the law, you are a beneficiary of Mattathias and his son's faith. Now, if you would like to understand more about this history, and especially how it relates to Daniel chapter 11. Remember, everything we just went through, it was prophecy that it was going to happen anciently during Antiochus' time, and also it's going to happen again in our time, because there's duality there. If you want to read a booklet that will really help educate you in that study and show proof of the Bible, you can request our booklet entitled History and Prophecy of the Middle East. You can go to the website right now, watchjerusalem.co.il, hit on the literature tab, and that booklet will be there for you to download right away or request a hard copy for free anywhere in the world. So we have time for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Please do send your feedback, and you can do that by writing emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il.